Hello and welcome to the very first edition of the Urban Mechanic Podcast. It's a brand new podcast produced by the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research. My name is Matthew Hennessy. I'm the managing editor of the Manhattan Institute, and I'm here with my colleague, Stephen Ide, who is a senior fellow of the Manhattan Institute Center for State and Local Leadership, and editor of publicsectorinc.org, the Institute's website dedicated to analysis of the ongoing crisis in state and local government budgets. We're recording this Urban Mechanic podcast at the Manhattan Institute in the heart of New York City, in the shadow of Grand Central Terminal. And Steve and I are going to talk about a range of issues that the Institute and Public Sector Inc. focus on, many related to the particular problems of cities and states, how they're run, what types of leaders they need, how to keep them safe. We expect the conversation will take us to cities and states across the country, but we're going to start right here in our own backyard in the Big Apple, Gotham City, New York, New York. Steve, it's hot. Today it's very hot in New York City. And another thing that's very hot right now in New York City is the mayor's race, the race to succeed Michael Bloomberg, who is finishing up his third term. That's 12 years as mayor. And whoever it is that succeeds him, and there's a bunch of people running for that job right now, is going to inherit a very sticky problem. What is that problem?
Well, over half of New York City's budget is devoted towards personnel spending, salaries and benefits for public employees, and almost the whole workforce is unionized. So all fiscal issues are inevitably labor issues in New York City. Currently, the Bloomberg administration and the unions are in confrontation over three issues, basically. The first issue is health insurance contributions. The vast majority of New York City employees do not contribute anything to their health insurance, unlike the case with government employees elsewhere in America and certainly in the private sector. The second thing is retroactive pay increases. Since 2009, many unions have not had a contract. They've been technically working without a contract, and thus there's a question over whether or not they deserve raises for their work that they provided to the city in 2010, up until the current day. And the third thing is the wage increases going forward. What sort of contracts do we want to negotiate for workers for future years? In the mayor's race, this has up until now been a relatively minor issue, although the pressure has been increasing due to reporting by the New York Daily News in particular and others, and Anthony Weiner, above all people, who has been using this issue of requiring employees to contribute more to their health insurance, perhaps as a way to distinguish himself from the pack. And he and Speaker Quinn in particular seem to be beginning to fight over this issue.
Well, I want to go back to the second thing that you mentioned, which is this demand for retroactive pay increases. It's not like the cops and the firemen and the teachers don't get a bump every year. When the unions negotiate these contracts, they build in steps and that are related to seniority and stuff like that. So every year their pay goes up a little bit, right? But we're talking about a negotiated raise across the board. And they're saying that over the last 4 years, there's been money that they should have earned that they haven't. And they actually put a dollar figure on it, or people have estimated it'd be like close
$7 billion.
The city doesn't have that kind of money, right? I mean, where would the city find $7 billion to pay back wages to its public workers?
Well, that's right. It doesn't have that money. And the city's budget is about $70 billion. So you're talking about a 10, 11% hit to the city's budget at a time in
which... Well, what does that mean? The city's budget, that means that you're taking money away from something, right?
Right. We have this big problem in public finance right now where we're continuing to pay for services that were rendered in the past. This is most obviously the case with pensions and retiree health benefits where we're taking money from current taxpayers to pay for services that employees provided to the public decades ago. In the case of the retroactive pay increases, teachers, police officers were working during these years, 2009, 2010, the really peak recession years. They were getting paid. They were getting all their benefits. But they didn't get a bump in their in their base pay, a formal raise. You're very right to say that they were getting pay increases because step increases, lane increases. The terms of the past contract remained in place. So as you were gaining in seniority, yes, you were seeing your pay increase. But they believe that they are owed also increase in their base pay. And that's what, if the Bloomberg administration would, if were to, or a future mayor, were to settle up, as they say, to the degree to which the unions want them to, that would blow a $7 billion hole in the city's budget. Union contract negotiations generally revolve around two principles, fairness and affordability. It's certainly the case that this is not something that's affordable to New York City, but the unions believe that this is only fair, this is their fair share, this is what they are owed.
Let me read you a quote from an article that was in the Daily News this week, written by Glenn Blaine. Quote, "The unions have done well compared with inflation since 2000. As the cost of living rose 29%, the 130,000 members of District Council 37, which is the city's largest public employee union, enjoyed pay boosts totaling 36%. So the cost of living overall for everyone in New York City rose 29% since 2000, which is roughly the start of Bloomberg's first term, or just before. And the teachers gained 43% compared to that 29%. And the PBA, which is the policeman's union, scored 56%. So costs have been rising for everybody in New York City. Inflation is always sort of with us. And the public employees have, sounds to me, done better than most.
Yes, and I would say it's actually in the benefits side where you see the most generous compensation. You know, the idea that they're not paying almost anything for their health insurance is just extraordinary and completely out of step with trends elsewhere in the private and public sector. There is this problem, however, of so-called pattern bargaining. That is, when what one union gets, the other unions also expect to get. In 2008, the Bloomberg did settle with a couple of unions, granting them some raises going forward in 2009-2010. The UFT, the biggest union in the city, for covering over 100,000 teachers, did not settle. And the UFT believes that it should get what the other unions got in 2009-2010. And that alone would cost over $3 billion. And many people believe that that's something that the city is going to have to take on the chin. Maybe it might be able to push back on some of the other union pay increases, but that's going to be difficult given the norms that exist in collective bargaining negotiations. The city absolutely can't afford that, but unfortunately, this is the nature of public sector labor law. Sometimes affordability is not the overriding criterion.
So how do you think this is going to affect the campaign? The Republicans are all sort of talking tough. There's an independent candidate, a former Democrat, Adolfo Carrion, who is also sort of talking tough about this. But many of the Democratic candidates are seeking the support of these unions or have the support of these unions in some cases. Christine Quinn, who is the front runner at the moment, the city council speaker, told the Daily News, quote, "Let's face it, municipal workers deserve a pay increase." So do you think that the unions are looking to cut a deal with one of these Democratic candidates?
Well, you know, I think the candidates have said different things. You know, they do seem to understand that this is going to be a big problem for them. I mean, no politician wants to have to be cutting services to pay for things that people received in the past. It's just not fun. Politicians want to spend money. They don't want to and spend money for things that they're going to get credit for. This is not a problem that any of them want. For now, some of them can do, like John Liu, will just blame Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg's problem. You know, I didn't cause this problem. Bloomberg did it. Bill de Blasio said, I'm not going to negotiate in public. I'm going to, you know, he deflects the questions. Wiener has said that city employees need to start paying 10% of their health insurance premiums. More recently, it sounds like Christine Quinn is coming around to that position too. Everyone basically agrees that the unions deserve wages going forward. The question is what you do about health insurance and what you do about the retroactive pay increases. Health insurance is this thing that the Bloomberg administration really should have been on top of this number of years ago. Unfortunately, when Wall Street was booming, these pressures didn't exist. And so they let this one slip by. Now the Bloomberg administration is trying to cut a deal, as you say, before they leave office. But it remains to be seen whether or not they will succeed in that. But if they don't, this is going to be a problem for anybody who becomes mayor of New York City.
So the unions will get their pay increase. The question really is for you, are they going to have to kick in for their health and retirement benefits? That's the big question. Are they going to give anything in exchange for that?
Yes, and how you reconcile the need to get them to contribute more to the health insurance with their demands for the retroactive pay increases. You can't. It's going to be very difficult achieving both of those things through the negotiating process.
Okay, let's shift. Let's talk about another big city mayor who is stepping down this year, who has taken a totally different approach to governing than Mike Bloomberg, despite having been born and grown up only 10 miles apart, and that's Boston Mayor Tom Menino. Menino's been the mayor of Boston for 20 years. That's five full terms as mayor. What does it take to hang on to power for that long, and what kind of a mayor and what kind of a legacy does Tom Menino leave behind?
Yeah, well, we can distinguish between the style of Tom Menino, which I think a lot of the articles that have begun to assess his legacy have focused on, and also the substance of his leadership, where Boston is right now. Stylistically, in terms as a case study of urban leadership, he was an amazingly hard worker. He worked, 60-hour weeks. He would attend the opening of an envelope. He was omnipresent in Boston. There was a famous poll conducted 5 years ago where it turned out that over half of Boston residents claimed to have met him on occasion. So he excelled at this, what we call retail-level politicking. And no matter how dominant he became, even though he was mayor for life practically, he never seemed to take that for granted and continued to work hard on the nuts and bolts business of politics. He was also scandal-free. Over two decades, there was never any serious scandal related to him, to any of his aides. That's an extraordinary feat. And people say that was something that was deliberate, that as an Italian-American, I believe he's the first Italian mayor of Boston, he thought he had to be, as pure Caesar's wife, just above reproach, and could not have any associations of dealings with, backroom deals, crooked politics, and so forth. In terms of the substance, you can say a number of things, very positive things about where Boston is right now. Boston's, and especially if we want to talk about comparing it to other peers, large former industrial cities. Boston's population has been growing in recent decades. Fiscally speaking, it's rated AAA by Moody's and also given strong bond ratings by the other bond rating agencies. Has impressive levels of reserves. Although Menino himself was not necessarily a wonk, he did have competent people that he put in place to take care of these things. And Boston in general has a pretty respectable record of financial management going back a few decades. Boston is also just a very attractive place to live right now. You're talking about urban revitalization, downtown redevelopment, the so-called Big Dig Project, Central Artery Project. Although it was a disaster in many ways, and Menino himself was not responsible for it, it did improve the city by basically taking this highway and pushing it underground, and thus opening up a number of new areas downtown for redevelopment. And those, and assuming that development continues along the harbor, they call the Seaport area, that too will be an important part of Menino's legacy.
Let's talk a little bit about his style. Joe Kahane in the New Republic, quote, "He was never going to rouse his city to action. Instead, he split the difference between blustering pugilists like Rudy Giuliani and clammy technocrats like Michael Bloomberg, forging a third way of urban bosshood." Is that a style that you think could be exported? Do you think that he trademarked it? Are there other mayors across the country who can take some sort of a lesson from Tom Menino's reign in Boston?
In some sense, I think it's a very humbling lesson for those of us who tend to have very high standards when we're during election season, for when we think who is showing their stuff, who seems to have the real credentials to take on the task of running a city as complicated and challenging as Boston or New York City. Menino was a total fluke. He was a career politician, virtually never had a job in the private sector, didn't even have a college education until actually after his daughter graduated from college. Very late in life did he go back to college. You know, he's inarticulate. He just doesn't impress you very much. And only began his career as mayor by being appointed to the position after Ray Flynn, the existing mayor, became ambassador to the Vatican. So he arrived accidentally, but then proceeded to demolish the political competition throughout the rest of the next two decades. This certainly had a stifling effect on civic life, political life in Boston, but you have to give him credit for that. As far as exporting this model, it's hard to say. You know, I think that there probably are examples around the country of other people who are unassuming, unprepossessing, but yet are doing, you know, a decent job giving the challenges that they face grappling with American urban life.
Okay, that's all the time we have. You can find this podcast as well as daily commentary and analysis about the Manhattan Institute's important work on state and local issues at www.publicsectorinc.org. I'm Matthew Hennessy for Steve Ide and the rest of the Manhattan Institute Center for State and Local Leadership. Thanks for listening to the Urban Mechanic Podcast.